are going to get started. As you know, we are, as I hope you know, we are here to discuss fantasy and geography. I think we've got the best possible topic for this entire con, and these people are going to help me prove it. So what I'd like us to do is go down the table, if each person could briefly introduce themselves so that our wide-eyed and no doubt alert audience members know who you are.
Oh, start with me.
Wow.
Okay. My name is Joshua Palmateer, also known as Benjamin Tate. I'm published under both names with Daw Books. My most recent novel from Daw Books is Shattering the Lay, which is a fantasy set in the middle of a fairly modern city.
Hi, everyone. My name is Gregory Wilson. I'm a professor of English at St. John's University in Queens, New York. I teach courses in fantasy and science fiction and creative writing and others. Also an author, first novel, work of epic fantasy a couple of years ago. My next novel, Icarus, is coming out as a graphic novel in a couple of months. And Ron Garner, who's the head of Silence in the Library Publishing, that's publishing it, spoke here yesterday. I also short stories in various places. And I co-host a podcast called Speculate, the podcast for writers, readers, and fans, with Brad Bollier, who's also in attendance here, that interviews and talks about the work of artists, authors, editors across the field, people like Kish Johnson and N.K. Jemisin and Brandon Sanderson and Pat Rothfuss, and most recently Anne Leckie, finished up with Ancillary Justice, and we have an interview with Lou Anders coming out next week, which is all you can find at SpeculateSF.com.
I'm Marie Brennan, author of the Memoirs of Lady Trent, and I guess my qualification for being on this panel is that I have gone so far as to get help making a tectonic map of that world, because that was how much I needed the geography to actually make sense for it.
Hi, I'm Robert V.S. Reddick, and I'm the author of the epic fantasy series The Chathran Voyage, The Red Wolf Conspiracy and Sequels. Last book was published about a year ago this time. And just before getting to World Fantasy, I finished the draft of my new book, which has drained me, but delighted me to be done. And I've been dividing my time between Western Mass and Indonesia for the last year and a half, and going back there in January for about 6 months. And I also have a background in international development, so my thoughts about place are to some degree informed by a lot of work in Latin America with conservation and development work.
Hi. I'm Max Gladstone. I write The Craft Sequence, books about sort of late millennial capitalism reconfigured as a fantasy world of necromancers in pinstripe suits and dead gods and with shareholders committees that are really wondering what happened to their return on faith investment. Three Parts Dead is the first book in that series. And I have a background in East Asian studies and a lot of international travel, and from a fictional angle, I'm really interested in the way that world systems end up reinventing geography, and that people reconstruct physical places as social places in their own communities. But kind of my angle here. Also, just general weirdness.
We are all for general weirdness.
Right.
So my name is Siobhan Carroll. I'm a professor of English at the University of Delaware. I study fantasy. I also write some of it. You can find my fiction in places like Lightspeed at right this week. I've got a new story out at AE, the Canadian Science Fiction Review, and of course in some anthologies by Alan Gatlow. But we are here to talk today about fantasy and geography, and I admit that we've had sort of a little pre-conversation over emails. We thrashed out
some
ideas. I know. Oh my God. We are going to advance further in adventurous directions in space and time for you here today. But in that conversation, Robert actually brought up a really interesting point. He said, you know, what do we actually mean when we're talking about geography on this panel? Are we going to be talking about just maps and fantasy? Are we going to be talking about climatology? Are we going to be talking about conservation of watersheds? You know, there's so many potential topics that we could talk about in relation to geography, and my answer is all of them, right? Right here, we are going to single-handedly thrash out fantasy and geography.
In 1 hour.
That is right.
But some terms have already been thrown around, you've heard a reference there to place. One thing that cultural geographers do is draw a distinction between space and place, and they use those words differently. They use place to mean a defined location like home, or like your favorite park, a place that people have a strong connection to, the borders that are firmly defined, and we talk about these places. They're usually places invested with value, whether that's good or evil, and we think of people's identity as being determined by them. By, for example, in London, the Tower of London, that is an example of a place. London itself, arguably, is a kind of place in some types of fiction. It is an icon that if it gets destroyed by Godzilla, we worry. Space, on the other hand, is the abstract field through which you move. It is the blank space on which maps are drawn. It is that blur out your window. It is flyover country. It is the abstract region you don't care about. So space and place. And of course, one of the claims that cultural geographers tend to make over and over again, that fantasy is sometimes repeated, is that capitalism, particularly globalization, destroys place. You know, they are coming to knock down your favorite park and put up their parking lot, right? They are going to take your place and turn it into space. And Tolkien, to some extent, I have argued elsewhere, was kind of all about this, right? What do people do when it comes to the scarring of the Shire? Well, the forces of industry come in and they knock down your party tree. Those bastards. I can say that at 11 p.m., right? On the geography panel. But we have a group of people here who have written about geography and fantasy in very different ways. Marie, earlier you mentioned the importance of that you put into designing your world for a natural history of dragons. And so I thought the one way we could kick off this panel is to ask, me just to put out there and ask you guys, when you came to your own fiction, what were some of the things you thought about when it came to the geography of your world or setting?
Well, for my academic background is in anthropology, and so honestly, when I think about these things, my mind goes first to the culture of the people that are living in a particular place. I actually don't think first about, you know, kind of the place itself. I think about the place in terms of the people who are there. So it's somewhat unusual for me to be writing a series where I have to sit down with a climatology textbook and a tectonic map. Because I am starting first with the community that is there. Though I am aware, and increasingly so as I'm doing this series, of the ways in which that does interrelate with the physical reality of where it is that people are living. But I do tend to start usually with the culture, and then the other things around that kind of come from that.
Like Marie, I'm starting off often with a sense of the culture that I want to be portraying in a particular work. Since the craft sequence is about economics as a magic system, basically, I start thinking about resource constraint a lot. So the question of what are the constraints that a particular culture is operating under in terms of the availability of basic resources, or even the availability of land. So in the second book, I'm dealing with a city that's in a desert, or it's relatively water poor, has a large population, used to be sustained by human sacrifice to rain gods. Then there was a rebellion and they killed the rain gods, so where's the water going to come from? And so you have a culture that's built up to have a certain set of relationships with their local land and with local resource constraints. Third book ends up having is set in an island, which gives a whole different sense of sort of spatial constraint and awareness of local space. This is very cultural, and it's not really on the sort of physical geography side of things, though. Maybe other people can talk more about that.
I was going to say, but you have to take the physical geography into account when you're creating the culture.
Absolutely.
Like you said, you know, if you're in a desert, water is going to be important, and that fact is going to shape the culture of that particular society. So, you know, as with anything in writing, there's no nice one clear answer for anything. I think that the two end up playing off of each other. The geography shapes the culture, and the culture shapes the geography. And I think the same thing happens with the characters in the book as well. The way that I personally write is I usually start with the character, and the character is living in a particular place, and I'm like almost totally organic, so I don't have anything much planned out when I sit down and start writing, except maybe a couple touchstones of the story along the way. And so what I'm doing is while I'm writing, is I'm the character themselves is exploring the geography and the culture all at the same time. And so the way that I'm writing, the two are playing off of each other. You know, so if I'm in the desert, if my character is living in the desert, of course they're going to be concerned about water and where is their water going to come from. And then as I'm writing about that, I start factoring in the fact, okay, how has this shaped their culture? How has it shaped their religion, their interactions with other people, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm using the geography to shape the culture and at the same time shape that particular character for that particular book. And in all of my books, I didn't realize this until after this was pointed out to me by some people, some fans at a convention and whatnot. All of my books, they came up to me and they told me that the setting itself, the geography and whatnot, actually came across as an actual character in the book. And I think that's extremely important in any kind of fantasy novel. You want your location itself to feel like a character, that it's actually shaping everything and everyone that's living in it.
Yeah.
Can I just ask a question about that? Because I think in our discussion, we this notion of the landscape as character came up. Can you say a little bit more about what that means? Because does that suggest agency to the place? To the place? When I think of character, I think of it doing something that's got that sort of hinge of intention.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that. I don't personify the location in that sense. Basically, what I think of as, okay, in my very first novel, the first one that got published, not the first one I ever wrote, first one that got published, I have a young character living in the slums of the city, and a couple people read the book, and they came up to me at like a signing, and they said that the slums, which I called the dredge in the book, they said the slums felt so real to them that they felt like it was an actual character. So no, I didn't have, you know, the slums as an active character in the book, but at the same time, the character was living in the slums, so the slums were affecting that particular character and shaping that particular character.
That's really interesting. Question. Place can have a drama of its own, is,
yeah.
I guess, what I was imagining, and maybe that's where you
were. Yeah, that's kind of where I was about to jump in with. It's just this notion that we talk about place as a character, but this actually means that place, when we're raising this issue, it means that place is having sort of its own agonistic structure.
Yeah.
Like the place has things that it wants.
Or it has personality, right? And the feeling that you have come to know it and that you have like a fondness for it, an attachment to it, or a hatred of it, or whatever, that the reader has created an emotional attachment to the place. That's what I think of when people say the place is a character. Not that it's doing stuff, but that the reader cares about it.
But it can't even be doing things. Like, that you're not necessarily, like, for example, New Crobazon is just it's very characteristically almost envisioned city. It's not even realistically envisioned, because if you tried to build New Crobazon, it would like explode in 3 seconds, right?
Or even possibly George R. Martin's setting where winter is coming.
Yeah.
Right? And the character, the
Forever.
Two characters in the book seem really
destroyed
to ignore that the landscape is about to act on you in a really big way, and you should probably pay attention to that.
Yeah.
But Marie, you early brought up the point that there are definitely some fantasy fictions out there, and speculative fictions of all kinds, where the setting isn't a character, right? In some cases, you read books and you're like, well, I had no sense of any of these spaces that the characters are moving from, apart from those capitalized names that I couldn't really pronounce. And yet, that's not necessarily a flaw, right?
Yeah, or, I mean, Max characterized that as the, you know, Planet of Hats thing, right? They have that one characteristic, and we will have a scene there that shows that characteristic, and we move on.
This is the country of honorable people.
Yeah.
The country over there is the country of merchants.
Yes.
Because there are no merchants in the country of honorable people, and there are no honorable people in the country of merchants, which would just confuse the hell out of everything.
or you know, just Star Wars, where it's the swamp planet, or the
yeah.
desert
yeah,
planet,
the single biome.
Yeah, it's just swamp. Yeah.
That said, though, I think a lot of the characters often become extensions of the city in a way, and yeah. so if you think of it all as being part of that place, so if you look at something like Ian McDonald's The Dervish House, where Istanbul really is the main character of that story. The other characters are very interesting, are very complex, are not all, you know, from Istanbul, and that means whatever that means, but they are distinctively of a place, they are distinctively in that area, they are different extensions of what Istanbul would be, and we've had a chance to interview Ian McDonald and talk to him about it, and one of the things that he said was he was struck and overwhelmed, as he's often been in his fiction, by the vibrancy of the place. It doesn't count as agency, but it clearly counts as something where these characters become, living characters become an extension of what that city is, and not every place will do that. I mean, there are places that don't have that kind of distinctiveness or vibrancy, but a place like Istanbul, which has as much history and as much depth and as much complexity, then becomes its own thing, if not with agency, certainly he would say with vibrancy.
I feel like that dichotomy can get pretty dangerous, though, because, I mean, I grew up in a town of 300 people in Tennessee, and it's really easy to, even growing up in that town, to think this is a no place. Like,
right.
this is yeah. the place that, goddammit, I want to get away from.
Yeah.
But looking back on it, there's a point of view in which that town becomes every bit as fascinating as Istanbul. Like, you can create that. It depends on
how the perspective is rendered, right?
Right.
If the characters themselves are rendering it from a particular perspective, you may have characters within the town that feel, as you say, I can't wait to get the hell out. The reader reading that will anticipate and read that place then as being no place.
Well, then we end up in this sort of space it's Guy de Maupassant, right, has that collection of essays called The Geography of Imagination,
yeah.
which I'm wondering if it's a healthy term to introduce here, because ultimately the whole illusion of the story is taking place inside the mind of the writer, or
right.
in a sort of union of the writer and the page,
right.
or the text. So there is a kind of genius loci that is operating throughout the course of an entire text.
Sure.
Maybe it's actually investing a location with a particular personality, but like the very warp and weft of space in a novel has a personality behind it. It's the personality of the writer or whatever else is going on.
Or the persona created.
Yeah, exactly.
Nice. Asked earlier to, like, made references to or questioning about how the background of the writer shaped it. And of course,
yeah.
I think we're alluding to that here, and one of the things that also comes up is the way that culture can shape our attitudes towards cities. And one of the reasons that so many would-be writers are desperate to get out of small town America is because our culture keeps telling us that really interesting things don't happen there.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, New York is the only place where anything interesting happens.
I know,
sometimes LA or San Francisco.
Sometimes LA, but it's
yeah.
generally if you're in LA, there's lunch or
everything.
This is why New York
yeah.
routinely gets destroyed, so
well,
we don't have to worry about that anymore. Movies just.
You do
everyone
have that.
Wants to destroy New York so that interesting things can happen somewhere
elsewhere.
Else.
Yeah, exactly.
You do have the backlash from some writers that I think is very justified, where they will write about more rural areas and say, you know,
course,
these can
yeah.
matter deeply to
sure.
people who live there.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, I think, for example, the whole Southern tradition, I mean, I think you, everywhere you turn in the South, you're going to find Tennesseans and everyone else who are going to say, absolutely not. We have been trained also to understand that we live in a delicious stew of wonderful, often dysfunctional stories.
Yeah, I mean, that's Faulkner, right? You have got Naha County
for
thousands of pages.
And, maybe jumping the gun a little bit, but I think it's worth, you know, putting this in as a side note right here. Yakhmatova and every other...
Can you pronounce that again? Because I don't think I have Etoff.
Yakhmatova.
Yeah.
I can even spell it. I'm very proud of it. Every setting in any fiction, whether it's set in the world we know or secondary world, is a fantasy. It is the author's fantasy, and it cannot be anything else. I mean, Joyce used to brag about how if Dublin burned to the ground, then you could use Ulysses as
right.
the blueprint for rebuilding
right.
it. There's some reason to say that. There's a reason to be proud that way. It's also not true because it's his wild, deranged Dublin.
New Dublin, now with dancing soap.
Yeah, but just putting all the streets back in their original locations doesn't recreate the city that
exactly.
was there. It recreates, you know, his landscape of it.
Which is
yeah.
what Siobhan was getting to earlier, right, with this distinction between place and space and the notion that where you have fantasy novels in which you're sort of traveling around, but there is no actual place geography.
Yeah. Well, so let me bring up an example of that. In Mievel's The City in the City, specifically, spaces yes. are becoming places all the time. And again, that gets back to the perspective, right, of the characters that are living in it, where, and if you haven't read it, I'll try not to spoil it, but please go read it. It's an incredible book. The characters from each space, how do I put this without spoiling it? Characters from each of these places, we'll put it this way, can both see and unsee other places. And so it is literally up to them whether or not something is going to be conceived of as one city or another, hence The City in the City. That's not spoiling, it's in the title.
No, I don't think that's a spoiler, but, right, you know, because it's that it's sort of outed in the
That's yeah, yeah, so that's fine. Yeah. But I mean, so the point is there, so each of them are, you know, literally constructing it along, and yeah, the mind of the author overall is doing that, but it's also fascinating that in a way the reader has an opportunity to sort of go along with one character or the other depending on who they want to follow, because it's not even clear to some of those characters whether they should see or unsee a city at a given moment.
And I mean, I actually haven't read that book yet, so I may be riffing off a different idea rather than touching on what Mievel's doing, but it does seem like that's a good literalization of what we're saying about, like, you can be living in that small town and think of it as nowhere and yeah. insignificant,
right.
or it can be a deeply meaningful space to you, or
right.
a place, rather, not space, place. And that's, yeah, that is in the decision of the individual in real life, yeah. as well as in fiction, you know, how meaningful this hotel that we're in right now, I'm like, yeah, it's yet another convention hotel, but I could, by thinking about my experiences here, just inscribe a lot of this with meaning that would yeah. stay with me.
Maybe 10 years from now, we were going to feel a deep nostalgia. And
do you remember that time?
An effective right. connection to this place.
But it's the sort of ritualistic nature of convention space, right?
Yes.
You're recreating a
all convention places are one convention
yes,
place.
Yes, they're all connected to one another.
The most fascinating panel is a discussion of convention spaces. That's clearly...
The geography of convention.
Space has meaning.
Well, and I actually wanted to add something here that I think, when I was talking about the reader having, like, you know, the fondness and the attachment to the location, I think the ways in which the books fail to create that, like, places character effect for me, the two things that they're frequently lacking are, number one, variation, you know, the Planet of Hats thing, right? Or the city where everybody is the same kind of New Yorker or whatever. And even more importantly, the sense of history. And I don't mean the epic fantasy history where, yes, 500 years ago a great battle was fought here, but rather, yeah, 20 years ago that district burned down and they're still working on rebuilding and a whole bunch of, like, new people came in who hadn't been living there before. And just, you know, that sense that the place is not static in time, mm-hmm. that things have happened there, that things are changing, it will be a different place in the future. The stories that succeed in bringing a place to life to me are aware of that, and they don't just present this sort of eternal present for that location.
So I'm going to bring up a book that I bring up all the time, and it's maybe a little bit of a left-field introduction to this conversation, but anthropologist named James C. Scott wrote a book called Seeing Like a State, which is... it's this very weird book of anthropology. The subtitle is How Certain Schemes to Improve the Human Condition Have Failed. But one of the core arguments in this book is that states and sort of bureaucratic organizations over time try to rewrite the sort of social map to make the universe that they're operating in, whether it's a small town, whether it's land arrangements in a small town or weights and measures or currency, more visible to a central authority that has no social investment in the sort of on-the-ground situation. And to do this, you do a good example would be weights and measures. For example, the size of a bushel of wheat for taxes in the medieval period used to be a matter of negotiation, basically, between the peasants and the feudal lord. You're supposed to pay 3 bushels of wheat on your field in tax, but what's the size of a bushel of wheat? The Lord wants it to be as high as possible, but if he makes it too high, then there's going to be an enormous peasant revolt, and you can't actually pay for that many soldiers all of the time, so you end up with a sort of negotiated compromise. But that negotiated compromise doesn't actually sort of flow uphill if you want to create a bureaucratic city-state that has nation-state that has a dependable tax base. So you say that a bushel of wheat is so many grams of wheat.
Then you have to define a gram.
So then you have the standardization of weights and measures as a way to make tax revenue and agricultural product, like, visible to a central authority. And that's kind of the danger that we get into in epic fantasy, especially sometimes, right? Where you want to have, as the author, perfect visibility into the minutiae of everybody's life, and so you plan it all out. So, like, this is the district of the town that is the district in which people live, and that's the district where people go to get drunk, because nobody, of course, ever gets drunk where they live. And you know, and it explodes out to entire continents and sort of regions.
And I'd like to jump on that, if I may.
Yeah.
It's one of the things I was reflecting on for this discussion. I think it's a very, very natural temptation, especially if any of you, like me, came out of a role-playing games background before starting to write fantasy.
Well, the games came after the writing, but...
Okay. Yeah, but, so, it's very natural when you're making a secondary world to want that detail, and I think that many of us make worlds that are sublime, that are creative, that are unusual, that are wonderfully fleshed out and so on, and we fill our notebooks with this loving precision and depth of history and description. We may be ecologically literate to some degree and work that in all these things, and at a certain point we say, okay, I've got it down. Now, if only I can convey this efficiently and thoroughly.
Yep.
And that may be exactly the wrong thing to do. You know, that inefficient conveyance and
illusion
and partial conveyance of that may be the only way in for your reader. And, I mean, I never really addressed your question, Siobhan, at the beginning. You know, where does this enter into my process? But, Joshua, you alluded to it in your answer. I mean, for me, I don't even have a character at first. I have some mental state that some character may have, a moment of shift, of hinge, of feeling, or an incident, and that's like the little bit of sand, the precipitate that falls in the solution from which the crystals grow.
Yes,
right?
Great image.
And I feel like that is, for me, the way that I make room for all of these considerations and give them some meaning. Because, I mean, ultimately, when we're telling stories, all we have is someone's perception, through which is the keyhole through which the whole story has to reach the reader, right? And that, you know, that's much more obvious in a first-person account. You know, I'm going to tell you what happened to me and my grandpa when we went across the ocean and got eaten by, you know, spiders or whatever. But it's also true in a third-person setting. At some level, some disembodied, unidentified perhaps, but a teller of some voice and form and selection process is deciding what belongs in the story, what doesn't. It may be a closer reflection of the writer intentionally, it may be somebody who differs from that, but someone is deciding these are the experiences that from some imagined perspective were worth holding on to and give it all meaning.
Yeah.
And what's not there doesn't matter. We, in Tolkien, we never get to go to the Sea of Rune. We never get to go to the Ash Mountains. They're there on the map, and I've always wondered till I die what actually goes on there. But we don't get to go there, and it would have been wrong to have a little step aside. Hello, I'm the historian of Eridor, and I'm going to actually tell you about the Sea of Rune for the next 6 days.
It's probably somewhere in the history of Middle Earth.
There's a dramaturgical concept that's very similar. There's a dramaturgical concept that's very similar to this of, like, the playwright has to do all of this world building in order to make the characters make sense, but in the end, the only thing that actually exists for the audience is what is on stage.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's what I was going to point out when you were talking about creating, you know, like, I've got the calendar for this world, and I've got, you know, the metric system, and, the, you know, all that stuff for it. You can have all of that down there, but when you're actually writing the story, it's the characters that are going to bring out the different aspects of the city and stuff. And even if you're in the exact same place and you know, like, the layout of all the streets of your city and you know what the buildings all look like and, you know, et cetera, you put different characters into that exact layout and you're going to get totally different reactions to that. I mean, you know, the person that's in the city but comes from the slums is going to have a totally different reaction to that setting than, you know, the upper class, you know, aristocrat that's just coming into that city. You know, one of them
brought to one hopes.
Yes, yes. In good writing, I would think that they would have completely different reactions to this. And so that's one of the things I think is cool about geography, and one of the things we're kind of complaining about with the, you know, this is the planet of swamp, you know, is, you know, that's not the point. The point is, here I have this setting, here I have this character, and my character is reacting to this setting in a particular way. And that reaction is supposed to tell you stuff about the character, but it's also supposed to tell you stuff about the geography. I mean, one of the coolest things you can do in fiction is have somebody walk into a room and explain what they see in the room, and then have somebody else totally different walk into the room, and they're going to see totally different things. Right. They're going to have a totally different reaction. It's physically the same room, but you're getting two totally different pictures or totally different...
filtered through perceptions.
Perceptions of that room.
I wanted to say, and I think this, you just made me realize this exists both inside and outside the text. I wanted to argue with what you said a moment ago, like the only thing that exists or matters or whatever is what's on the page, right? Especially when you're writing about a real-world location, but to some extent, even with an invented setting, there is... the added ingredient that is the reader's own knowledge and assumptions, right? So, like, I was reading Rivers of London, or Midnight Riot, the first of Ben Aronovich's series, and the very beginning of it, the character, this cop, is walking around Covent Garden. I've been to Covent Garden. And so I am bringing to that all of my familiarity with that location, or, like, if it is, the old generic medieval fantasy city or whatever, I'm bringing to that what I know about those settings. And so it is weird that... You can't account for this, obviously. You cannot control what the reader is going to do. But just as a character walking into a room, or two characters, will see different things, a reader who has intense experience of big cities will read your big city story differently than the one who grew up in a rural background
That's also the case. I mean, I live in New York City, and I can tell you that, people who live in, Bed-Stuy have a very different opinion than people who live in Riverdale. I mean, there's an extraordinarily different approach for even people who live in the city, which is why it's amusing to go elsewhere and people be like, you live in New York City, do you know, because clearly 7,999,000.
Texas?
So I think one of the interesting things there is it has to, in some ways, I think it has to then reflect to the reader, even if it doesn't necessarily jive with their own opinions, some organic reality to it that they can see where there was an organic reality to the way it was presented within the city. So that, for example, because what you were referring to before is what I often call the source book problem. I'm a member of the Writers' Symposium at Gen Con, and Gen Con, which is very gaming heavy, talks quite a bit about this, right? It's the notion of you want to see the gazetteer at the back of the book. You want to see the index and the glossary and all these other sorts of things. Yeah, exactly. And weights and measures. And part of the issue there is that you're obviously pulling things away from the story, and you're pulling things away in a way that wouldn't even make sense even if you were relating it in real life, so that cities themselves developed differently also. If you go to Boston, Boston makes no sense in terms of grids. Boston and Providence, I'm convinced that Providence, Rhode Island, is a one-way street to the center that you can't escape legally. It just spirals, right? And I know this, having driven there many times. Whereas cities like Indianapolis, to a degree, are much more, not entirely, I have friends from Indianapolis who would be annoyed if I claimed it was vastly different, but it is in some ways more of a planned city, and they would admit that, as opposed to a city that sort of grew up more organically. And so trying to plan it out ahead of time, trying to put the cart before the horse, somewhat literally, means that sometimes it doesn't have that organic feel. So I don't know whether it has to totally jive with the reader's expectations, but it at least has to feel, I agree with you, that it comes from some organic reality that the author would have known.
I want to just jump in and point out there's actually also a danger sometimes in jiving too much with the reader's expectations, because in that case you're also, to some extent, playing to the way culture currently perceives a space. So, for example, look at how that's played out in a lot of like bad imperialism in sort of some early texts. Like, well, the people that live in that exotic setting are all the same, and they behave in the following ways, and the desert is dusty, and here's a bunch of cliches, because that's what the reader expects, and we have to play to that.
Edith Nesbit, for example.
There was even something, a little more close to home example. A little more close to home example, there was a situation, if I'm remembering this correctly, a year or two ago, where Jim Butcher had described an area of Chicago in language that got a lot of the people who lived there very angry about that they didn't feel was very representative. I mean, it's not like Chicago is in Jim Butcher's books is necessarily isomorphic to Chicago in real life, but like, the point of view that his source was taking to these particular areas of Chicago was particularly skewed.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, a moment ago you reminded me of, there was an article recently on Strange Horizons. I can't remember the woman who wrote it, but it was originally an address given at a conference on Diana Wynne Jones' work, and it's talking specifically about, like, place in Diana Wynne Jones' novels. And you said something, I don't know if you used the word, like, accessibility, but that was what I sort of footnoted it here in my notes so that I'd remember what to say. That she actually explicitly avoided in most of her books ever making the cities that her stories took place in be a specific city in an identified fashion. Though she very clearly drew geographical elements from Oxford and Bristol primarily. And she did say at one point that one of the reasons she avoided naming things specifically most of the time was that she wanted it to be something where the reader could sort of like access that without feeling, oh, I've never been to Oxford.
Right.
And so nailing it to one place might make it harder for the people who haven't been there to kind of get their brains into it,
yep.
Right? Because they would feel like I'm not imagining it right or something. And so, yeah, for the small town reader who's reading about a big city, it's got to be done in a way that they don't feel closed out of it.
Yeah, well, this can end up, at least in mainstream fiction, getting your work dismissed as regional.
Yeah.
If you're not careful.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Something that Lauren Bucus, we interviewed for The Shining Girls, is a lot of that book is set in Chicago, and she had exactly this concern, which was that she's South African, and was she going to render? She knew what it was like to have people try to set books poorly in South Africa, so she knew what it felt like, and she was incredibly anxious to be able to render it, not just, you know, a modern Chicago either, but of course, you know, Shining Girls is a time travel story, and there's historical elements then going on of Chicago, and to be able to establish it correctly and not as seem as if it's, this is someone who did, you know, an hour of research on Google to figure out what Chicago was, that was deep concern of hers, especially because she felt keenly her alienness from it, and to be able to sort of represent that was important to her.
So just to underline something at this point, folks, so clearly there's a politics to how we represent space in our fiction and how we approach it as readers that just as current and often interlaced with the issues of how we represent things like race and gender in our fiction.
Yep.
And these questions impinge on each other. We're past the halfway mark at this point, so I would like to start throwing the floor open to questions if people have them in the audience.
The floor opens beneath you.
It does.
We did my whole
space.
Did you check for floor tracks?
Yeah.
Yeah, question over here, sir.
I'm curious, what does that mean for you collectively? You map the world or sort of geographical markers as plot points or as plot outlines for your stories. It seems like the maps at the very beginning of Phantom Novels are both geographical wayfinding tools and also plot outlines for stories of all.
Yeah, they're also a check on lazy writing. My first novel,
yes.
When I was in a draft of it, my editor, John Helfers, was nominated for Hugo twice, was a military historian. So I had a small cavalry force that was galloping from one place to another, which I had sort of blithely said was going to take, you know, so they go from here to there, you know, carry the one, it's going to take maybe 2 or 3 days. And John was like, you know, Greg, you know, how far is that on your map that you're looking at? And he showed me the map. He sent me a, you know, copy of the map. I was like, well, that's probably 100 miles. He's like, how fast do you think they could do that? These armored horses of yours? And I was like, I said, sparkly magic. That did not sell. So in that case, you know, the map was really a check on, you know, making it clear that I could visualize the space that I was trying to render, and not just, unless they were the horses from Krull with the, you know, the flames, hooves, and, you know, they were never going to get there. And it was,
you not have the flames?
That's true.
Yes.
That's true. But it would be, that was a rewrite I did not want to cut down. But I think, so I think in that case, the map was not so much a plot point. It was very much a check, an outline, you know, sort of a further kind of bar to me on being careful to not let my imagination go wild, or specifically be lazy. I had to be able to be consistent. It's fine to establish, and this is the case not just with geography, it's fine as a writer to establish any rules that you want, so long as the rules are maintained consistently. And if you want to tell me that you're in a planet where gravity is, you know, X amount of what it might normally be on Earth, if that's the implication, that's fine, as long as then someone doesn't plummet to their death off a cliff, going faster and being more affected by gravity, apparently, than someone on Earth would have been. What happened between page 5 and page 50? That's the sort of thing we need to be aware of, and so that's where a map for me was helpful.
Yeah. Does every, or probably not everybody, but how many people here know about Diana Wynne Jones' Tough Guide to Fantasyland? Got a number of heads. So one of the things she says in there, because this is actually really relevant to this panel, I think, because she talks about, ye olde epic quest fantasy in the context of, like, a tour. It is specifically framed as, you are going on a tour.
Yeah.
And so a lot of the critique of, like, the tourist approach to different places. But one of the things at the very beginning is, at the start of your tour, you must find the map. You will visit every location on the map. It is no use trying to skip any of them because your tour will not be done until you have visited them all. And so she was mocking exactly that checklist thing. I think for me it's kind of mostly gone not with, map and then that is the outline that the story goes to. It's I write the story and then go, okay, here's the places I've named. I better make sure the reader knows where they are. And, you put those on the map, and then maybe you throw in a few others just for, like, verisimilitude, but...
Maps can also help orient you within narrative space as well.
Right.
For example, I'd spent, while I was working on the craft sequence, I'd spent a lot of time reading, like, urban fantasies to just figure out what else the market was like out there before I was going on submission with the books. And during this time, a friend of mine gave me a copy of Tagana. And I'd never read it before, so I just missed that element of my education. And it was this feeling that was kind of like coming home in the particular way of opening the book and finding the map there. I'd been reading a lot of literary fiction, I'd been reading a decent amount of urban fantasy that had been set in like American cities, basically. And so all of a sudden, here is this map of this country that I've never seen before. And I know, in my deep heart of hearts, that every city that is marked on that map, I'm going to visit. And I can probably even chart for you the direction in which I'm going to visit these things. And I know what we're going to do in most of them. And it just felt so comfortable. I knew exactly what kind of book I was going to read. And of course, then... Okay, plays with that and screws you up and like gets you into sidelines and it's really wonderful, but the existence of the map at all locates me within the sort of enormous narrative space of fantasy.
You also can't undervalue, I think, the power of having a visual space, as you said, open up the reader's mind, because the maps usually are at the front of the book, right? Open up the reader's mind before they begin to explore that narrative space. Even if you don't go from place to place to place and you hit every single one, the fact that it has opened it up for them visually, I think, is important, and it's important not to sort of entirely dismiss the fact they're about to slog through, 130,000 plus words of mostly just text, maybe with a couple of illustrations if it's really cool, but mostly it's going to be text, text, text. Having the sort of visual thing that's there in their mind, which then can be played with and developed, and you're going to zoom in ways that the map does not zoom in, right? But having that, I think, as an opening space does make a difference, and that is powerful. I think it's a valuable thing when done properly.
I agree, and in the most basic, subjective way as a reader, I've always had an affection for them when they're done well.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Like anything else, I think... they're an option, they can be a great, powerful, joyful option, and if they're not done well, they're worse than not
then
having
them. They can be terrible,
yes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah,
so
that's true.
And there are many ways it can work, and many ways, the map itself cannot be a thing of beauty, and then you don't want to look at it when you might need to.
Yeah.
It can be a crutch.
Yep.
Yeah.
Or it can be something that you just, as you are experiencing the book, you begin to feel a falseness to, again, if there's a sense that these things are all here because you're going to go there. That's not how we actually encounter maps in our lives, of course.
Mm-hmm.
So, like anything else, done well, it can be a great thing.
But that's back to Tolkien, right? Places that we didn't actually visit, or he did, and clearly, but we didn't. And, what is that place? That gives it a sense of space beyond the covers of the book.
Or Le Guin in Earthsea has all these wonderful islands.
Right.
Yeah.
Sometimes they come up in conversation.
Right.
Many don't.
So I've got a point here. Sure.
Well, no, I was just going to say that I write epic dark fantasy, and there are no maps in my books. I have a map at home, and the map at home is playing the role that you guys are talking about for the reader, where, I see that map at home, and it has all the coasts and everything, and it, in my head, it makes the world more real for me.
Did you do it afterwards? Okay.
Usually I have the map ahead of time.
Okay.
But it opens up the world for me, and all of a sudden I can see
the space that the entire story is going to happen in. And in my stories, typically, they don't go visit everything that's on my map.
Yeah.
And so what it does for me as a writer is I can see the big picture. And in my stories, and to be honest, most of my stories happen in one city. So even the epic fantasies happen in one city. So the reader is only getting a sense of one or two or three cities that, even though I have this giant map with all of the continents and all of the, you know, but just from my perspective, the reader doesn't need that for the particular story. What I need is I need to see the big picture. I need to see the whole world as a place, essentially, where this is going to happen.
Could I actually add one thing before? I also do find it interesting the way that the role of maps in fantasy has changed, because they used to be, I think, just a thing of epic fantasy. You're like Tolkien imitators. And you got to the point where people would say things like, if I pick up a book and I see there's a map in the front, I put it down again, because they didn't want to read that sort of thing. And I think it's become more common to start having like city maps in books as we get more kind of city-focused fantasy, and it becomes important to see where the neighborhoods are and how they interrelate. And I feel like that map sends a very different signal than the world-spanning thing.
There's been a very patient person here with a hand up.
You were talking earlier about the cultural expectation we have that interesting things happen in cities. And I think that reflects in the way there's an unfortunate tendency to think urban fantasy and contemporary fantasy are synonyms.
Yes.
And is there a very open field for the writers who actually want to write contemporary fantasy that's set not in cities? Is that an open field? Is that something that you used to see more of?
So there's a historical component to that, which you just made reference to, and part of it is that because we began, right, with epic fantasy that really took place, there were cities, but a lot of those places, Lord of the Rings takes place outside. It's the travel, right? It's the mountains, it's the hills, it's the wilderness, right? And the wilderness is the thing that fired Tolkien's imagination, and he does then construct these incredible cities like Minas Tirith and places like that, but what we're really focusing on is the travel. Right, yeah, is focusing on the travel between them. So as there was this urge then to distinguish oneself from that, right? It meant that everyone sort of went away from it. It was like, well, never mind about all that. Everything happens in a city because cities are modern and new and hip or something, right? But I agree that there is this sense that wanting to explore outside again is important. I'll bring up a name. Courtney Schaefer's The Whitefire Crossing is a book that came out from Nightshade a few years ago, and Courtney is a mountain climber. So a lot of the experience of that book, the entire book, more or less, 90% of it, is literally the crossing of this one massive mountain and how the magic is drawn from the contours of the land and how there are options as to whether you drain the life force of the people around you or whether you drain the life force of the mountains around you and what's the impact of that and various things of that sort, really exploring sort of the wilderness environment. It's not, sadly, modern, you know, it's not 2014 wilderness fantasy exploration, and I take your point, it's not contemporary in that sense, but it is her clearly not, number one, not wanting to return to epic fantasy, but also not wanting to just spend all the time in the city, so there's something to that, I would say.
Got another hand over here.
Yeah, it was just it's late. The comment sparked by the last question, and the concept of place and space, and interesting things happening outside cities. No one's really done like a fantasy equivalent, I don't think, of something like Winesburg, Ohio. One person. Yeah, it's great. Thank you. But which is a story about a very small town that you were talking about earlier. There is one character who wants to leave, and that's all he wants to do is leave. But there are so many other interesting stories by these people who are trapped not by the smallness of the town, but by the experiences of their own lives. And there's just this way that you can do a story about people that doesn't have to do with wilderness and also isn't necessarily set in an urban environment. You're just taking a look at the small town, the relationships between people, and the sort of different tragedies and scars that everybody has.
Well, I think that one thing that may partially account for that is another sort of training we've all subjected ourselves to or been subjected to over the years of reading a lot of fantasy, which is the grandeur. That it's all got to be a vast canvas. It's all got to be the world shattered and remade or saved or doomed.
Right.
Yeah. And all these dramas that are intensely involving with just a small number of people on a small scale that in mainstream fiction you find all the time. Somehow we ingest the idea that that's not enough.
Yeah.
Also, a lot of that thing that you're talking about, the sort of non-metropolitan spaces, that gets aggregated by the horror, or irrigated to the horror
True.
Space, right?
Yeah.
You have Stephen King writing about angry, writing about intense passionate interconnections in small towns and deep scars that then, for example, in Needful Things, just explode all over the place
yeah.
and demons start showing up. And we're in a, I'm wondering if there's something like cultural, sort of a cultural space that we're entering that's close to the cultural space that, for example, Conan Doyle is writing in with the Sherlock Holmes stories, where everything that happens in London is very logical and there is a reason for it, and as soon as you get outside of London, it's just like crazy.
Yeah. Nuts.
What's going on?
Yeah.
Yeah.
There are some people who are writing that kind of thing. The only title I can think of right now, because it's nearly midnight, is Alex Bledsoe.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's The Hum and the Shiver, or The Shiver and the Hum, whatever.
Hum and the Shiver.
Hum and the Shiver. And there's somebody else whose name I am forgetting.
Laird Barron does this, too. So does John Orner Jacobs. There's a big
yeah.
Southern tradition as well that ties in. Frankly, by the way, Andy Duncan as well, who writes about this stuff not just with place, but also does it with humor and humorous fantasy that takes place in towns, which is a tradition all the way back to Mark Twain, is
yeah.
something which also is possible, and so people like Jacobs and Barron are two people
yeah.
doing that too.
There's a woman who I think is doing, she has like two books out and they're set in like one of the Dakotas or something like that. So,
Wide Open and Deeper Down.
Okay, Wide Open and Deep Down, did you say?
The,
okay.
Yeah,
so there are some people out there doing it, but you're right that it's not very common yet. And hey, maybe we will see a swing as backlash to urban fantasy.
All right, green sweater.
This is shifting gears a little bit, but how do you avoid the climate of hats problem? So you've got this these characters, and they come to this town, and you have, you know, a page or a paragraph even to describe what this town is like for them. How do you give it the verisimilitude that you might feel in real life, you know, you guys?
Well, think about what happens when you go to a place and you don't know ding, wab, nothing about that place. You walk in and you flown to another part of the world and you don't know anything about what's going on. What is it like to be there? You can do the same thing on the page, I think. And that, I think, is the only way I know how to be honest to that experience. Because this came up in the linguistics panel this morning, if anybody was there. There's this sense that at some point you are going to simplify.
Yeah.
Because reality is
if
more...
If you're only there for a paragraph, you can't do that
yeah.
much.
But even if you're there for a book, you're
yeah.
going to simplify.
Yeah.
And it's about making that choice to some degree. But, yeah, the planet of the hats, or, you know, all of Dune is a desert, all of Tatooine is a desert problem
yeah.
is...
Marie, I thought you did an interesting job with this in Natural History of Dragons, though, where you actually had the character admit, sort of, I portrayed it this way at the time, but I was totally wrong, and this is the travel writing convention.
Yep.
Yeah,
yep.
Well, and that, I'll tell you, that's the advantage of writing something that is an explicitly framed first person, like she's narrating her own life, because she can say that to people. But I will also say that when you think about your own experience of, like, if you're just in this place, if I'm only in a city for a day, then I don't experience its individuality, probably.
Right.
You know, the way that you develop depth is you spend time there, and I think giving the sort of shallow representation when it's a quick visit is kind of how it goes in life.
And you're picking...
There are issues of viewpoint parallax that you can use to
yes.
get around this particular problem. Like, you will imagine... I have run into a number of people who have been to Thailand for about 3 days,
yes.
right? And there are the people who go to Thailand for 3 days and will tell you, like, I had this really interesting, I had this great meal and that great meal and that great meal, and then I went to see a movie because it was the only place there was air conditioning in Bangkok, and, like, it was totally awesome, and I'd love to go back. Then there are people who will go and will talk to you in depth about a particular conversation they had with someone or some individual sense impression they got. Like, I saw this at a boxing match. And then there are the people who are very, in my opinion, kind of dangerous, who will go and say, the Thai people are so generous.
Yes.
You know, so like, there are a number of different ways that people can experience space, a new space, in a very short period of time, and they can walk, if you have a group of folks who are all experiencing the city, they will all simplify exactly like
yeah,
Marie and
but they might simplify
saying.
Differently.
They'll simplify differently, and
yeah.
so when they're walking out, you have this perspectivism issue of, like, wow, I thought that was really great. I had this great time talking with this like street vendor, and he seemed like a really cool guy. And
but now I got mugged.
Yeah, I got mugged like three times. Everybody was starting fights with me. Well, why do you think that was? And so all of a sudden you have these seven different people's constructions of this space.
When done well, that can sometimes be a really good insight into the character's own limitations.
Yeah.
So I'll give the classic example of this, Heart of Darkness. Obviously, famously, Chinua Achebe attacks Conrad with some justification, not as much as he thinks, but with some justification for painting what he sees as the breakdown of one white European mind against all of Africa. And he's right that is a problem with the way that Conrad represents it. However, what Achebe misses, I think, and what's important for the question you just asked, is that this is a frame story, right? So it's telling the story of Marlowe's experience of going into it and the incredible limitations thereby of what it is that Marlowe finds.
Yeah.
So everything then is interpreted through him. If you view it as this is the white European view, that was the white European view, that Africa was one thing, one monolithic entity that was darkness, and that there was and foreignness, and not with any specificity or cultural involvement or engagement or any of the things that we've talked about today. If you want then to present the dangers of having people like Marlowe in control of your world, there is no better way to do it if you're able to render it as this is a person who by his very nature is unreliable and you know, problematic and drawn from that environment, right? The danger happens when you sort of, without realizing it, take on his assumptions yourself, and then when you slip out of that frame, you're writing the same way that Marlowe did. Don't write the way that Marlowe did, but if you can shine the light on what Marlowe is, that can, depending on the project you're involved with, be useful.
But of course, you can also have characters who are, to a greater degree, aware of how little they know.
Right, yeah.
And that sort of lens can be very liberating.
Yep.
To be the lens you're working with, too. I think it's just being true to who is seeing.
Anne Leckie does that again. Yeah. And So Justice does that very well in that book. Yeah.
And is a sort of, I find it funny that we're sort of mentioning Heart of Darkness because, and I will qualify that Marlowe is someone who pretends he knows everything entirely. The point of his narrative is that realization he doesn't, but it begins with a map, right?
Yep.
It's actually very fantasy emulative, or rather inspirational, in that it begins with him looking at the map and wanting to go to that space that he has seen and visioned.
Yep.
Folks, we're approaching midnight, I'm sorry, so I thought that
we're going to turn into pumpkins.
We can definitely continue this conversation in the bar. One thing that I wanted to at least close with was to ask you guys the suggestions of works we have not yet mentioned that do a really good job of representing or using geography in fantasy. So are there text stories we haven't mentioned that you would like to put out there for people to have a look at?
Invisible Cities by Italo Calvino.
Yeah, beautiful little sketches.
Yeah, it will make something come desperately alive, and it can just break your heart with the elusiveness of being able to hold on to a place that you have that sort of effective attachment to.
I've already mentioned Dervish House, White Fire Crossing, and City in the City, but I would also mention Malengro by Charles DeLint, which is very good at getting both Ottawa within Ottawa and Ottawa outside of Ottawa. So it covers both sort of city and more rural environments in a very complex way. And that's it, ever. No.
Infinite Jest by David Foster Wallace does this wonderful job of creating an obviously all Boston, that is cities that we flooded 8 years ago or 20 years ago or still exist, and seeing it both from the perspective of natives of all different walks of life and orientations and from outsiders.
Now I'll mention a world fantasy nominee this year. Clagett's and Duncan's McCullough Springs is a beautiful portrait of the history, racial and spatial, of a place in Florida.
I would just say our guest of honor, Kay. I mean,
yeah.
Pretty much almost everything by him has that aspect to it. So.
And again, of the nominees, Helena Wecker's The Golem and the Genie with Turn of the Century New York, and Sophia Samatara, Stranger in Alondria, in particular because she's very much representing a protagonist who has his own personal, view and attachment to this city that then he goes and experiences, and it's a different character would probably describe a very different version of that city to you.
That book is a masterclass on so many things.
I'll give a pop, too, to my friend Brad, who does the podcast with me. Brad Bollier's The Winds of Kalakovo does this also. The whole series, The Lays of Anaskaya, which is both sort of Russian, Persian influenced, and is very unusual both geographically and culturally in good ways. So.
All right, folks. With that, I'd like to give a big hand to you, the brave audience, and to my whole family.